If you happen to be a reader of Spinoza, you might quote his phrase, "Peace is not an absence of war. It's a virtue, a state of mind, a disposition for benevolence, confidence, justice." If you're a younger person in America, you might use the term peace as a colloquial expression for goodbye. If you want to give peace a chance, you can recall the John and Yoko bed-in, as well as the anthemization of the recorded song on Vietnam Moratorium Day, October 15, 1969, where the chorus, "All We Are Saying," was punctuated by Pete Seeger crying, "Are you listening, Nixon? Are you listening, Agnew?" And if you've listened to Eduardo Cadava this evening, you might be tempted to say that calling it peace is to name it as war, or the couplet War Peace. If you consult the website Say Peace in All Languages or related sites, you will encounter a long chart showing that in Afrikaans, for example, peace is vrede, in Arabic, salam, in Tibetan, jebde, in Spanish, la paz, in Mandarin, jeping, in Yoruba, alifia, in Sanskrit, shanti. Peace is one of the possible translations of the Russian mir, which means simultaneously peace, the world, and peasant community. The Hindi word for peace is shanti, meaning public quiet, order, exemption from or cessation of war with public enemies, exemption from subjection to agitating passions, tranquility of mind or conscience, reconciliation, and harmony. In Mandarin, the idea of harmony is foremost, and its complex associations inform tonight's event insofar as Aaron's email message about his experience in seminars with Chinese students was in the back of my mind. He wrote to me, "Concerning peace in Mandarin and Cantonese, very fascinating discussions with students about this topic, particularly as the word peace has been co-opted by the government to equate with harmonization, a process of ensuring societal harmony, imposing order, etc. There's always been an association between peace and harmony in China, but the government's interpretation has become the dominant usage such that our workshops have to unpack and somehow create another space to talk about the term." In a forthcoming book, The Fifth Hammer, Pythagoras and the Disharmony of the World, Daniel Heller-Rosen mines the importance of harmony as a paradigm of natural science that enables the representation of the world through the elements of mathematics and clears a space for noting something unrepresentable yet real. This Pythagorean construct gestures toward a notion of what I would call world fitting, with conceptual affinities to disegno, design, a concept of Renaissance art theory that means both design and project, outline and intention, idea in the speculative sense as well as in the sense of invention. Pythagorean harmony implies an aesthetics of the political not incompatible with artificial intelligence, an ordering capability characteristic of the ordinateur or computer. According to Antoine Picon, ordinateur was proposed in 1955 in French by a philologist, Jacques Perret, who'd been asked by a student to suggest French names for the new IBM machines that were about to commercialize in the country. He suggested ordinateur, which applied to the capacity of someone to arrange and organize, and of course also possessed strong religious connotations. In one of the French dictionaries, Littré, the adjectives applied to God, bringing order to the world, as well as to the person in charge of ordaining a priest. So peace also is related to the French term ordonnateur, which is administrative parlance for officials with power to authorize expenditures. Peace along this economic axis brings us to the Greek oikonomia. The Republic and the laws, in these texts by Plato, he used oikonomia to construct a figure of administration in the ideal city. The Platonic economy is the science of the management of goods and persons in a state led by a sage endowed with temperance and justice. Access to these cardinal virtues passes through education and requires the exercise of dialectic. The legislating faculty is none other than the logos, that is, rationality, discursive rationality. And slightly different from this was Aristotle's construction of this term, which removes it slightly from a utopian notion of administration and associates it more with practical problems connected with everyday reality of the family and the city. As a result, in both thinkers, oikos becomes a crucial notion in the sense that it determines the site of a confrontation between political realism and justice. So as you can see from this cursory foray into the names for peace in multiple languages and the clusters of its cognates, synonyms, and semantic cousins, the word peace is a premier untranslatable. What do I mean by an untranslatable? I'm borrowing this term from the philosopher Barbara Cassin, who used it in the subtitle of a project, perhaps Kantian in its aspiration toward a cosmopolitan approach to language, that was published in France as the Vocabulaire Européen des Philosophies, Dictionnaire des Intraduisibles, literally in English, the Vocabulary of European Philosophies, a Dictionary of Untranslatables. In conceptualizing the project, Cassin was committed to activating philosophy as both a medium and a life form. Each entry term is treated as not as a static nominalism or as a universal, but as something of a live speech act. And I'm currently editing, as Aaron mentioned, the English translation of this Dictionary of Untranslatables. So imagine what I'm involved with, and here's somebody from the team who's been helping us. And many of the examples that I'm briefly cover tonight are drawn from the articles from this book. It's at once a history of philosophy and a massive translation exercise with entries that compare and meditate on the differences furnished by all the European languages, some of them the ones that have large numbers of speakers, some quote-unquote smaller languages. And here, the untranslatables tends to refer to a term that is either been left historically untranslated or is transferred continually from language to language, as in terms like polis, begriff, praxis, aufheben, lieu commun, logos, or that has been constantly subject to mistranslation and retranslation. The untranslatable can sometimes be defined as a nub of semantic opacity, as something stubbornly resistant to equivalence or commensurability. It's also conceivable as a boundary line of the sacred, resonating in the edict, "Do not translate here," or "Thou shalt not translate me." And it's arguably a convergence point where the void of meaning in one language finds its counterpart in another. The untranslatable challenges the soft international diplomacy model of translation that's traditionally defined by the desire to screen out disagreement, to avoid encounters with insecurable knowledge. The untranslatable runs the security risk of non-communication, even as it serves as a repository for the remainders of what gets lost in translation. Approaching the word peace through the lens of the untranslatable bears directly, I would say, on the problem of peace as such. Very simply put, I would venture that we cannot really undertake a project of perpetual peace, of universal peace, if we're unable to grasp its untranslatability as a word. Peace might seem to entail the necessity of a political Esperanto, a lingua franca designed for a one-size-fits-all world, but the palpable reality of global monolingualism, of globalish and its variants, renders this dream of a universal language of peace highly suspect. It becomes all too easily compromised as a rampart of neoliberal monoculture. A better option, I would suggest, involves relinquishing the fixation on a common world language of peace in favor of discrepant iterations of earth justice that refract the condition of untranslatability in the world's actual languages. The question of how you translate peace was prompted by the Slots initiative to reread Kant's classic treatise Toward Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Project, and we've already heard two wonderful papers on that. Published, as was mentioned, in the wake of the 1795 Treaty of Basel between France and Prussia, the work is often interpreted as Kant's endorsement of French Republican as a beacon of universal community. The title of the essay in German is Zum ewigen Frieden, ein philosophischer Entwurf. As many have noted, the phrase ewigen Frieden is controversially rendered in English as perpetual peace. It would seem to refer back to an essay that influenced Kant, published in 1712 by the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, Projet pour rendre la paix perpétuelle en Europe, which is given in English, a project for settling on everlasting peace in Europe. What comes to the fore, of course, in comparing the German, French, and English is a kind of translation loop in which semantic and acoustic nuances lost in one language are displaced to or recuperated in another. In this case, the Abbé's perpétuel, in its guise as the English word everlasting, draws closer to Kant's ewigen, whilst the English translation of Kant's ewigen by perpetual recoups the Abbé Saint-Pierre's original French word perpétuel. Why does this matter? Because the way we translate the qualifier ewigen has consequences for interpreting Kantian peace and the lexical circuits of synonyms and word worlds that spring from it. As it oscillates between eternity and everlastingness, ewigen, like its pendant term heiligen, to make holy, to make blessed, sounds a distinctly ecclesiastic note. And this is confirmed by biblical expressions like peace everlasting or the everlasting father, as in the King James, Isaiah, the mighty God, the everlasting father, the prince of peace. Ewigen in this sense is a word destined to culminate in the Christian belief in eternal salvation, Seligkeit. In his writings, Kant plumbs the theological dimension of eternity, but he employs it in a darker way to provoke an encounter with the prospect of temporal abyss. In Das Ende aller Dinge, The End of All Things, a short fragment published a year before the Perpetual Peace essay, he begins with the image of a dying man hurtling towards eternity, a scene of Dasein's grand exit from Zeit, of being's exit from time. It's a common expression, Kant writes, especially when speaking piously for a dying man to say that he is passing from time into eternity. In fact, this expression would mean nothing if by eternity one were to understand the infinite passage of time. For then man would surely never emerge from time, but would always only pass from one moment of time to another. Thus, by this expression must be meant the end of all time, ein Ende aller Zeit, in man's uninterrupted survival, though we nonetheless mean by this duration a quantity that is utterly incomparable to time. This thought contains something a bit horrifying, says Kant, for it leads to an abyss from which there is no possible return for whosoever falls into it. He then goes on to quote Albrecht von Haller's imperfect poems on eternity, with strong arms eternity holds fast in that stern place, him who leaves nothing behind. As if to underscore the paradox of holding fast to nothing. It would seem that Kant was hoping to suspend the correlationist assumption that one can only access knowledge through correlates of thought and being. Pushing the bounds of speculative cognition, Kant imagines supersensuous beings, übersinnliche, that do not stand under conditions of time. Ewigkeit, in this context, becomes weirdly compatible with an end-of-days scenario that's not so much a millenarian account of Judgment Day as it is a Houdini-like exercise in eluding the chokehold of time on being. The modifier, ewigen, serves as a placeholder for the unthinkability of eternity or timelessness or final end. It is perhaps this sense of a final end that Kant referred to very, very early in 1784 in a comment on something that he was writing that didn't reach fruition, but which was alluded to by a colleague of his who wrote in an essay, a favorite idea of Professor Kant is that the final end of the human race is the attainment of the most perfect political constitution. And he wishes that a philosophical historian would undertake to provide us in this respect with a history of humanity and to show how far humanity in different ages has approached this final end or distanced itself from it and what is still to be done to attain it. Now, if we go back to the standard translation of Ewigen Frieden as perpetual peace, the word peace may be illuminated from the perspective of property, as in when a leaseholder of a lease or title lays claim to a property in perpetuity. The Oxford English Dictionary informs us that perpetual, in a rare usage, can designate a perpetual position, possession, or right of ownership. To have peace in perpetuity would then be comparable in this description to possessing a right to own some piece of peace, to have a stake in it, as one might in a trust or testate or commodity future. Kant's notion of cosmopolitan right, das Weltbürgerrecht, while it doesn't directly mine this proprietary dimension of the perpetual, contains the phrase den Völkern der Erde, the earth's peoples, a phrase that implicitly assigns earth the position of proprietor in chief. As Kant says, because a narrower, wider community widely prevails among the earth's peoples, a transgression of rights in one place in the world is felt everywhere. And this gets back to that idea of that we were talking about earlier, of something that hurts or is in pain in one part of the world is registered in another, according to his notion of cosmopolitan right. It's predicated on the earth's prior, unconditional claim to all peoples, but in a sense subverts an ownership paradigm by placing earth in that position and converting it into a deprivatized notion of deprivatizing the right of nations or even of the range of claims by international superstates. In each of these examples, what is revealed is the extent to which the meaning of Friede, of peace, shifts according to how one translates ewigen, that is, whether stress is laid on eternity, everlasting, or perpetual. But we can also turn to the word Friede in its own right, which derives from the Indo-Germanic root prit, meaning joy or satisfaction. It's a term that navigates between Freude, joy, pleasure, satisfaction, and frei, freedom, from the Indo-Germanic root prei, meaning to protect, care for, or consider with love. To say Frieden is to assure the well-being and judicial order of the community. To be zufrieden is to be calm, content. There is likely a connection here to the Hebrew shalom or the Arabic salam, whose common root salima denotes safety, welfare, prosperity, and more generally, intactness in person or wholeness as thing. Now, the Anglo-Saxon derivation of peace tells a different story. English peace comes from the Latin pax, and while this builds on the post-classical semantic reserve encompassing welfare and prosperity, the English use historically privileges diplomacy. Indebted to the Anglo-Norman and Old French paix, it underscores civic relations and freedom from civil unrest. And we start to see a semantic thread winding its way through amity, concord, pact, settlement, the enforcement of public order, securitas, defined as care, the protection of to a nation or people guaranteed by a monarch, peaceful relations among fellow citizens. As in Kant's notion of cosmopolitan right, which settles for what he calls a negative surrogate, a federation that prevents war and curbs hostile tendencies, only because you can't actually have a positive, you can't attain a positive world republic. So he has this negative federation instead of the positive world republic. This idea of, like this notion of right, peace is valued as a form of negative liberty, a freedom from conflict, a mode of stasis. It's related theoretically to the problem of stasis, which paradoxically in Greek, Liana here to correct me, denotes not the absence of war, but rather faction, civil war, or political standing. As Peter Rhodes notes in his book Athenian Democracy, faction is a conventional English translation of the Greek stasis, one of the most remarkable words to be found in any language. Its root sense is placing, setting or stature and station. Its range of political meanings can be best illustrated by merely stringing out the definitions to be found in the lexicon: party, party formed for seditious purposes, faction, discord, division, dissent, and finally, a well-attested meaning with the which the lexicon omits very often, namely civil war or revolution. Moses Finley notes along similar lines that stasis refers etymologically to a position, that the position should become a party, that a party should be constituted for the purpose of sedition, and that one faction should always call forth another, and that civil war should then rage. This is a semantic evolution whose interpretation should be sought not in philology, but in Greek society itself. Finley is referring here to the nature or the idea of the Greek polis that was not a state, but rather what anthropologists called a stateless community, a relatively unstratified egalitarian community characterized by the absence of public coercive apparatuses, the absence of central authority, social hierarchy, and kinship identity gave room for individual deliberation and made politics indispensable. Thus, the Greeks are said to have invented politics in an ethical mode, that is, in a mode that seeks to curb political standings or standoffs through morality, education, and self-restraint. The fear of stasis in ancient Greece was apparently directly related to the absence of public means to check seditious factions or to deal with divisions that might be the outcome of having political standings. If we dwell for a moment on the Greek stasis in its root, sta, to make stand, we can grasp how stasis functions kind of like a pharmakon, that is to say, as both poison, faction, civil war, or even the word stasi as a state spy command center, and cure, and in the sense of a standoff between equal factions that produces equilibrium, or in political terms, peace. Spinoza's 1677 political treatise stipulates the necessity of having two equilibrated commonwealths as a precondition of the right to peace. He writes, "Hence it follows that the right to make war belongs to each separate commonwealth, whereas the right to peace belongs not to a single commonwealth, but to at least two, which are therefore called allies." In order to perpetuate, then, peace must achieve stasis, an ideal, in this sense, purely hypothetical, but a condition characterizable, as Curtis Allen characterizes it, as an absolute zero endothermic reaction to conflict, the absolute excess of lack, nullified freedom. Stasis politics is more a condition of gaming, you mentioned that, than of realpolitik. It corresponds, perhaps, to the proverbial level the playing field or zero-sum game. But perhaps there are more pragmatic political uses. If we take another route through the Russian word mir, which means both peace and world, and they also are homonyms, so you say mir, and it's really only the context that will tell you. It's generally, according to Antoine Meillet, the model for this transition from peace to world was furnished by the administrative Latin of the empire. Pax Romana became an expression designating all the territory ruled by Roman peace. Now, you could almost say that the same but not quite relationship of mir to mir gives us another kind of untranslatable world peace, but it would almost be like world, world, or peace, peace. But it's interesting that as soon as you introduce the word world, you encounter this incredibly gargantuan baggage that attaches to it from German, Welt, the word Welt. In fact, it's such that if you follow, at least as I am, how the Welt emerges from this vocabulary of European philosophy, it's as if Welt sucks up all the energy of ontology, of the subject, of philosophical history into itself, and sort of crushes other cognates in Greek or affines, like or synonyms, Greek cosmos, Latin mundus, Hebrew olam. These are all represented in modern languages, but after Kant, whose dissertation written in Latin in 1770 dealt with the notion of the world in general, Welt gathers this momentum that I just mentioned to the point where it seems that German is truly the language in which world is most fully philosophized. I'm going to start to conclude here because it's late, but it's been possible. Let's see. Yeah. While the study of Welt as an untranslatable shows how bound up it is conceptually with biblical and Enlightenment notions of time, it also sheds light on an interesting tension registered in Kant's anthropology between having and knowing the world. And Michel Foucault translates a passage from this anthropology and renders Weltkennen, world knowing, as connaître le monde, and Welthaben, world having, as avoir du monde, the latter translation recalling the fact that German Welthaben was originally a translation of the French import. That's another one of those loops. But the philosopher Pascal David wants to modify Foucault's translation with the French avoir les usages du monde, which takes it away from the everyday meaning of having company and closer to the very French notion of savoir vivre, or knowing the ways of the world. In English, we enter then, once we climb through all of this, new thickets of untranslatability. Because, in a sense, what does having the world mean in English, especially when it's being contrasted with knowing the world? We don't really have that term. Having the world, or the variation having world, one could say, actually names something that doesn't exist in English, or for that matter, German or French. It formulates the idea of a property drive harnessed to the mastery and the acquisition of resources, information, technology, know-how, and symbolic capital. Master of the universe might be the closest colloquial in translation of Welthaben, and not having world could lead philosophically in the direction of someone like Peter Singer, whose just enough notion of distributive justice encourages a non-extractive approach to the earth. If we draw all these associations back into rapport with the Russian-inflected construct of world peace, we come back, world peace, we come back down to earth, so to speak, as the locus of a pre-capitalist justice or of a terrestrial peace as the only perpetual peace worthy of the name. The word peace, then, and I'll just wrap up here, is an untranslatable. But each of its iterations in different languages yields a project. I prefer to think of perpetual peace as an eternity of translations that produces not so much an endless random stream of declensions, as I've sort of done in this free-form presentation, but rather a rigorous arraignment of discrete word histories. Viewed comparatively, these word histories reveal untested and as yet unthought configurations of theological and secular infinitude, of harmony and disenio, of stasis and oikos, of world having and not having world. I'll finish here and say peace. I'm still wired here.